In these 21 years, Alex and I have begun to look more and more alike, I think. He said that, and I thought, that's true. So, anyway, but I think we've been doing work that's more and more alike. I'm going to talk about the work that is published most recently in a book called Sensing Changes, which is a study of 8 sites in Canada which were radically transformed by mega projects from 20th century sitting down on their space and then adjusting to this intruder. But the first part of the background of this paper, which is in the Oral History Reader, is a commentary on consent in research with human subjects in vulnerable populations. So it's one of those hard parts of the work we do where we enter as oral historians wanting to collect stuff from folks whose lives have been radically unsettled, and we were wanting them to find the way to talk out of that unsettledness, to speak through that silence if they can. My colleague, Paul Makandawiri, who's a health geographer, one of our graduate students from Western, who came from Malawi, he was always troubled in the work that he did by the notion that he was be recruiting people to consent to participate in research studies which would be yielded I've had a brain injury in the last couple of years and I'm still finding my way out of it, so I'll try to give another start at this. Paul's a health geographer, a grad student from Malawi, who was part of our doctoral program at Western. He was always troubled in his work in Malawi, which was AIDS-ridden at that time, asking people to work with him when what he could give them in trade for their consent was access to drugs and clinical care. Where so often we work with troubled populations where the offer we make to them, they have to center in a hard arbitrage between what they've been customarily thought of as public stuff and what they've customarily thought of as private stuff, where they had to open themselves to us in a particular barter kind of relationship. So this was what made Paul uncertain about trading on these people people's vulnerability, but consent in trade for what? I found the same thing to be part of my experience in Walkerton after the water contamination. I was the lead researcher on the long-term health study there. People had lost babies, they'd lost friends, and we were trying to get them to think about how to talk about what had happened in that place and time. So it's part of my experience in Walkerton. Residents signed consent forms to gain... In Walkerton, they signed consent forms to gain access to medications and medical care. That's still a problem in rural Ontario, to find a general practitioner. And if you can find some people from a local university who want research done, that's a way to get a GP. So this paper attempts to locate the various ways in which consent is constrained, not freely given, but constrained when we're working with vulnerable human subjects. Everywhere, consent is constrained by past interactions, memories, and legacies of pain, not freely given, but bartered across power differentials. Paul and I began to use the diction of witness rather than investigator, the modest witness, unengaged, his or her observations not inflected by culture, a stalwart and resolute inhabitant of a terrain covered over by a culture of no culture. to emphasize, as some commentators claimed, that witnessing yielded not representation. This is the high modernist era of, the high postmodernist era of research. Inhabitant of a terrain covered by a culture of no culture, to emphasize, as some commentators claimed, that witnessing yielded not representations, but the fact of the matter. We came to and hope to linger in this airy open place, made and protected by the strict articulation and enforcement of rules which would safeguard our modesty, secure our claim to ethical research practice, and expunge the threatening shadow of standpoint. I can't speak for my collaborator, but I liked this place. It pleased me. I was not particularly keen to succumb to science envy, to snuggle into a fashionable high modernist cloak of objectivity, but I did and do value the company of poets. Just then I was occupying rooms in a U.S. college lately vacated by Seamus Heaney, the Irish Nobel laureate, and broadening my horizons by savoring his 2000 translation of Beowulf. As far as I know, Heaney never practiced oral history, but he translated many literary works, and something he wrote about translation struck me forcefully then and has lingered with me since. He characterized translation as long haul work. You stay with it a long time, identify with it in an imaginative way. You change it and it changes you. Translation, like oral history, flourishes in climates of reciprocity. You must engage or they will not engage. Yes? Reveal yourself and they are more likely to be open to you. It is precisely this engagement, once forbidden as a transgression of objectivity, that I find most pleasurable and generative in my practice now. Our guest from Italy illuminates this matter admirably in his account of his interactions with Mrs. Cowens, and we've all probably read that article multiple times, so I don't need to summarize anything of it yet. But it's a powerful example of this kind of interaction that is made of an opening by the witness to the person who is a witness to the witness. Now, too, I simply listen while not trying to be an authenticating expert, which was certainly the key core advice that I started in this kind of practice, was you were to be aloof and distant, and you would be able to be the truth teller, because the truth teller would come from that distance. I don't think that works. And certainly, Portelius told us many, many different ways in which this is not true. So now I too simply listen while not trying to be the authenticating expert, to follow the advice of Philippe Bourgeois, to listen in ways which entail a compassionate pact. Not enough?
I can hear
that. Okay. A listening comportment which comes to forge a contract of testimony, an investigator whose stance is that of a vulnerable observer. So they're very different from the starchy, distant person. I think of this as the foundation of a practical politics of solidarity. And I certainly don't think I need to tell you folks in this institute that how much it seems as if the best of the work here comes out of this politics of practical solidarity, which takes work. High maintenance, this, but I learned it most forcefully when I was talking with Laura Malachy, who models per week work on in Ruth Miranda on this practical politics of solidarity. My most recent work, Sensing Changes, is set among rural and village communities enduring radical landscapes change, where large engineering works have transformed their dwelling places and gravely alter the reference points for their senses, for knowing themselves in place. This is a form of tacit knowledge, the kind of knowledge which we carry with us, know with some confidence, but don't often speak. So it isn't, it's, we carry it bodily, sensually, in terms of practice, but we don't often or always or even necessarily carry it from the sensibility to the symbolic articulation. There's a lot that we know with confidence but don't speak and even can't speak. And this is a kind of challenge for us who want to know more about people in place and about how they tune their bodies to their place. That's what Sensing Change was about. So I've been working among rural and village communities enduring radical landscape change, losing track about how they knew themselves in place. This excision through the way in which we, if we move places, lose contact with the self, which was in former places, this is about filling in that lost knowledge which was tied to the relationship between particular body and particular place, where the body is made in terms of what it knows, what it gives precedence to, by dwelling in that place. This excision has been associated for some time with the ennui and collective depression which follow mega projects. Certainly follow the mega projects I knew from studying Canadian mega projects. These transformations in tacit knowledge I have begun to explore personally in an autoethnography of walking, because I'm in a situation now of learning to walk again. So it's not that the place is changing for me, it's the body who is interacting with the place. And I'm struggling to find that new way of knowing myself where I encounter the place around me in this very different way, where the stairs that didn't used to be difficult are very difficult, where a long way is very, very difficult, what I remember from previous parts of my life. So I'm learning to walk again, knowing an injured body as the interface between me and the world beyond my skin. So I'd suggest that if this is still fairly scrambled to you, that you can go to joypark.com, where there is a website for each of the studies in Sensing Changes. And many of them, the one in particular, of Iroquois, the drowned town of Iroquois, which with students I made a walking tour of the town that's now gone. But you can explore Iroquois. The only way you can explore Iroquois, because it's now under the St. Lawrence Seaway, is to go to the website and look at the streets and the houses one by one. And you can listen to the local people. We tied the local oral history snippets to the house and to the place that's being described. So you can get to know that place through the voices of the locals, and you can look and see the contour lines on the map so you know what's going up and what's going down. Similarly, there's a site that shows the air photos of what was Base Gage Town and where its Base Gage Town has lately been changed from being a tank testing range to going back to what it was before the military decided to have that base. And you'll see from those air photos a sense about the reclaiming of the pasture lands and the reclaiming of the forest cover, which was how the Acadian and then Scots-Irish settlers first knew that land. And it's in the 20 years that Bates Gage Town has been there, they've been struggling to reclaim that environment, which was to the grannies and grandpas of their community, what was familiar. So it's a possibility of oral, I have interviewed people talking about that change. Somebody urged me last night to also talk about the people of Gagetown. I had a grad student named Greg Marquis, who now teaches at UNB St. John, and he went with me to a series of social gatherings where the longtime residents of Gagetown regularly gathered every week, every 2 weeks, to play Scottish music and dance. And they were fearsome fiddlers, and we recorded their fiddle music and recorded their dancing, and what Greg called quadrille. Greg Marquis is an Acadian man, and we watched these folks dancing the quadrille, which was, though the territory had been turned into tank ranges, they met in the Orange Halls, and this was still a possibility for them to bodily reclaim the sense of the world and their movement through it, which had existed before the base came. And the delight on their faces is just wonderful to see. Anyway, you can just, anytime you have a computer in hand, you bring them up and watch their dancing. That's what I have to say.
Well, thank you very much.